This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Charlotte area children have returned to Charlotte Mecklenburg schools for another year. To be more precise, children from all over the world have returned to our schools. CMS has become increasingly diverse, and that diversity includes immigrant children. Staff members speak nearly 24 languages in an effort to communicate with students who speak even more. But the language barrier isn't the only obstacle. The style of American education that confronts these newcomers from around the globe can also be a shocker. The challenge to push past these barriers actually involves students, educators, and parents, and is a complex one that most of us don't know much about. So we've invited three people who do know something about it. Jose Hernandez-Paris is a diversity and multicultural educational specialist at CMS. He arrived in Charlotte at the age of 13 and was one of the first graduates from CMS's English as a Second Language program. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Mike.
Good to see you again. Dr. Long Kwok is Assistant Professor for Middle, Secondary, and K-12 Education at UNC Charlotte, who coordinates that school's English as a Second Language program and came to this country through a Vietnamese refugee program. Thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Rosemary Trajore is Assistant Professor for Urban Education at UNC Charlotte and author of the book, This Isn't the America I Thought I'd Find, African Students in the Urban U.S. High School. And she joins us by phone from Washington, D.C. Welcome.
Thank you.
Nice to have you all three of you with us. Someone at CMS once told me how many languages were spoken by students there, and I couldn't find it anywhere listed on any website anywhere, and I couldn't remember it. So do you know, Mr. Paris?
Oh, yes. Yes, we have the latest count. We have over 120 different languages spoken. In some counts, it could be up to 140. And we have students that represent over 151 different countries.
What are some of the languages that we might be surprised about?
Well, surprisingly, we have a lot of students from Laos. They speak Laotian, Thai, Eastern Thai, Gujarati, from India, Hmong, Russian, Syrian, Korean. It's just a variety of languages. It's amazing the diversity that we have.
Well, I mentioned at the very beginning, as you heard, that we have staff members at CMS who speak at least a dozen languages. Well, there are 120 different languages being spoken. How do you deal with the languages you don't have people... if you don't have people speaking these languages, how do you even begin to teach these kids?
Yeah, well, as far as the communication is concerned, we depend a lot on the community. There are a lot of interpretation, translation services in Charlotte. It's a very vibrant community, and we do have a very diverse community. Also, the students represent Charlotte basically.
Now, the two of you in the studio, Jose Hernandez-Paris and Dr. Long Kwok, both of you came to this country at various stages of your young lives. And came into a school system, or into school systems that were very different, I would think. And obviously, there was the language barrier. But was the language barrier the toughest barrier to overcome?
Well, language definitely is a big challenge for all students. But I think all students experience culture shock and getting used to a new environment, especially if they come, like myself, from Southeast Asian countries where there isn't a whole lot. And I came personally as a child of age 4, so I didn't attend school in Vietnam. But I think for me personally, the biggest intimidator was the lack of English skills, because failure to communicate with teachers and your peers can be a bit...
Yeah, for me, I've been in Charlotte for 32 years, and just being in Charlotte for 32 years is a cultural shock because this community is so different. Yeah, 1977 to today. It wasn't just the language; it was the cultural shock of the other students, because it's not just the student that's coming here, the immigrant student. It's also the culture shock for all the students, where there's a new population that comes in.
So you're saying the native population also has a culture shock when suddenly there are a lot of Hispanics or Asians or wherever people are coming in from.
And sometimes people do not dress or look exactly like what you're used to, and that takes some conversation with students.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Trahari is joining us by phone, and we're going to talk more extensively about this later on in the program, but you've done this whole study with African students coming into American schools and interfacing with African-American students in those schools. And you would think that the culture shock would be minimized, but it's the contrary is true, correct?
Yes. Everyone would expect that it would be easier for them to go into a school with African-American peers. But what happens, of course, is that the first thing they face is that their African-American peers have been misinformed about the continent of Africa. And the stereotypes are of jungle and savage and starving children and war and AIDS virus. And so there's already a negative connotation to being from the continent. So that is one of the first factors that affects students arriving from any country on the continent in any school in America, is that misinformation about the continent.
And you were here last week, I think, to talk about yes. bullying in schools. And as I read about this diversity situation, and you have kids coming in from all over the world, children can be cruel to each other. And if you don't look like me, if you don't sound like me because you speak a different language or you're having a tough time with English, or your clothes aren't right, or you're Asian and you really don't look like me, that can be very difficult, it seems to me. How do you get beyond that?
Well, I think, first of all, I think the impact of media on how children interact with each other is amazing. And sometimes they will say things to each other that they really don't understand the content or the context in which things are being said. Mm-hmm. I'll give you a quick example of something that happened last week. A parent came to me and told me that her 5-year-old child, this is a Mexican-American child, came to her and said that other children in her kindergarten class were calling her a wetback. Mm-hmm. And she didn't understand what the word meant. The child didn't, but she just knew it was hurtful. And she knew it was something that was bothering her. And so the parent had to go through this process of helping her understand how to deal with the situation and then work with the school to minimize that. So the relationship that children have are so affected by yeah. the media and how adults refer to each other.
And you have mentioned in some of the writings that you have done, Dr. Quach, that Asians in the United States are perpetual foreigners.
Right, and Frank Wu talks about that because no matter what we do, no matter how assimilated we become, we still look very different from our mainstream peers. So in the studies that I've conducted, the interviews I've done with many Asian students across North Carolina speak to that, that no matter how assimilated they become, no matter how perfect their English is, people are constantly asking, where are you really from? And digging for that information. Mm. So you never really quite fit in.
And, go ahead.
The same experience has happened to me even as an adult. I've, was born in Vietnam, but I've been here for, 33 years. So when I go to areas, rural areas or, up north or different places, people ask me how I learned to speak such good English, and I respond by saying in school, and they're just shocked that my English is so good, but I've been here most of my life. So
do you speak Vietnamese as well?
I do, and that took a lot of personal commitment because when you are not exposed to it, you don't really maintain it. So
In the South, Dr. Trahari, diversity used to refer to black and white integration and making that work. But increasingly, diversity seems to also include nationality and religion and sexual orientation, to name just a few different characteristics. And a lot of effort has been applied here, helping black and white students become part of the same student body. Religion has become a focus in some areas. Where does diversity of nationality fall on the scale of how we've been trying to make this all work?
Well, the Population Reference Bureau has a new report out, and it's called Children in Immigrant Families, Chart New Path. It came out in March 2009. And it says that by the year 2020, in the U.S., 1 in 3 children is projected to live in an immigrant family. And one of the things they state is that the immigrant youth are actually the fastest growing segment of America's youth population. And they will transform U.S. population and labor force in the coming decades. So this is something that we do want to really begin to address as a community and begin to include various ethnicities. And even, you know, Dr. Kwok will tell you that the term Asian includes so many different ethnic groups, and it is not a monolithic group at all. It is so varied in so many ways. And so if we could begin to recognize that kind of our categories of Hispanic or Latino and Asian and African, that within those there are people who come from not only different countries, but different ethnic groups within different countries.
And different cultures.
And different cultures. And that each of them actually, if we learn to include others, we expand in ourselves. We don't, like, shrink. We get bigger. Each of us as an individual can actually expand our world by learning to include others, no matter what the otherness is. But we expand by including them.
But fitting in is such an important part of a child's life. Every child wants to be in the popular group. Every child wants to fit in and feel good about going to school and not feel intimidated or unhappy about having to be there. How much more difficult is that for immigrant children?
Well, I can tell you from my own experience. And again, I'm talking from a different era, basically, because when I came to Charlotte, first of all, students didn't understand the fact that someone could speak anything different than English, that they couldn't comprehend why I didn't respond to them or I couldn't respond to them. And they would get upset with you because you didn't interact sometimes with them.
Would they talk louder so that you could
understand? They would. They would. Teachers too sometimes.
That's right.
But it is the communication aspect of not being able to integrate with other students to be something as simple as a joke. Mm-hmm. When people are laughing and you don't you're just standing there with a group of students and you can't participate is tough. Children by nature want to interact. They want to get to know their children. They want to be included. So the toughest part is the exclusion of, so for me, for example, right now, because of the, you know, over 15% of our student population is Latino, within the Latino community, there are more resources, both for students, for parents, and within the school. Mm-hmm. But for students that are really minorities, within a minority population, I think it's more challenging because it is more difficult for them to find peers in other support networks.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you're Latino, although there are dialects of Spanish that are being spoken throughout Central and South America, and if you extrapolate that out to Spain, I'm sure that there's difficulty understanding people from Spain if you're from Mexico. But with regard to Asians, there are probably hundreds of dialects and different languages.
Absolutely. And not just the language differences, but the cultural differences, the historical differences that exist across the different countries. And you know, many students and teachers assume that if you're Asian, you speak a common language or you share certain cultural values, while there are similarities.
We're going to speak some more about the diversity situation in schools here and throughout the country. And I want you to share with us a story about your own fourth grade experience when we come back, Dr. Kwok. We'll do that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Our program is made possible in part today by Beeson and Ellis Conflict Resolution, a decade of experience training a variety of professionals. A mediation training begins in Charlotte at the Duke Mansion from October 14th through the 18th. Details at BeesonEllis.com. And by the LNC Railway, offering vacations anywhere Amtrak trains travel in the United States aboard the J.P. Henderson, a luxury rail car with bedrooms, private baths, and personal chef. A video tour is available at jphenderson.com. Well, tomorrow we're going to talk about compassion and civility, two commodities that sometimes seem in short supply in today's world. Rabbi Brad Hirschfield says, "You don't have to be wrong for me to be right." In fact, that's the name of one of his books, and he says we can be civil to one another. He'll join us to share more of that philosophy with us tomorrow morning on this program, beginning at 9.
The recession has cut across race and income levels to push millions more Americans into poverty. Implications of the latest Census Bureau survey of family incomes on the Diane Rehm Show Monday.
And, of course, you're invited to join the conversation on the Diane Rehm Show. It's coming up from 10 to noon, right after Charlotte Talks, here on Listener Funded, 90.7 FM, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the immigrant experience in schools here and also extrapolated out throughout the country with Jose Hernandez Paris, who's a diversity specialist with CMS. He's sitting in our Spirit Square studio along with Dr. Lan Quach, who is an assistant professor of middle, secondary, and K-12 education at UNC Charlotte. And joining us by phone from Washington is Dr. Rosemary Trehore, assistant professor of urban education at UNC Charlotte. You wrote an article, Dr. Quach, last year talking about your own experience at a fourth grade school in Virginia. It was not a pleasant one, because your teacher never really accepted you. Now, this was a different time, perhaps, but I'm hoping that we're over this, that this would not happen today. But it was a situation where your teacher didn't particularly care for you and did not understand your family's experience. Are those issues still a problem in school today?
I believe so. I believe the school systems are working very, very hard to help prepare teachers to work with this community. And, you know, at UNC Charlotte College of Education, all the faculty are committed to helping teachers better understand diverse students and their the cultural differences that exist and the cultural incongruence that can also affect teacher practice.
You had to put together a scrapbook.
I did.
For a fourth grade project and show off your knowledge of Virginia history. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct.
And it was due at the end of the year.
Yes.
You didn't even know what a scrapbook was.
Right. And for me, even having, Jose shaking his head, having been in the country, since kindergarten, I had learned, I learned the language pretty well. I, exited out of the ESL program, but, there were still a lot of, cultural incongruences that existed. So yeah. When the teacher presented this project, to the class and said, we will need to, create this scrapbook. And, of course, my first question was, what is a scrapbook? And more importantly, where do I get one and how much does it cost? Because finances were a true struggle for my family. Mm-hmm. So, we lacked many, many resources that would allow us to just get in the car and go and buy one.
You didn't have a car.
We didn't have a
So going to buy a scrapbook at the Ben Franklin store, and you had to figure out what that was.
Right.
Was a major hassle.
Absolutely.
And your mom had to work extra hours to afford to buy a scrapbook. I don't know what a scrapbook costs because I haven't bought one in my entire life. I think the last scrapbook I had, my parents bought for me when I was in the fourth grade. So I have no idea what scrapbooks cost, but it can't be much. But your mother had to work extra to get it. And when the time came to get it, she bought the best one available.
She
wanted you to shine.
She did. So she bought, I'll never forget the green one. It had gold borders and it's very fancy.
So you bring the scrapbook home. You do all the cutting out of all the historical things and the places you've been, like Monticello and Virginia. And you put the scrapbook together and you have forgotten a key ingredient.
Right. A key ingredient that most households have in surplus, my own included, was glue. And so while this scrapbook took many, many months to create and construct, and I had to do a lot of research to, compile the information, the weekend before it was due came, and I found myself sitting at home with everything laid out and no way to adhere any of the materials.
And once again, you didn't have a car. So going out, jumping in the car and going to the local dime store to buy a tube of glue is not an option.
Not just the car, but the lack of, the
and
dollar.
Money.
Yeah, that it would take, yes.
So your mom made glue out of rice.
Yeah, she tapped into what she knew. So she went into the kitchen. She made a big pot of, steamed white rice. And as a child, she always wanted me to eat. So I was very confused by her cooking at that moment when I was just so distraught. So she brought the big pot of rice out and sat it down and started to show me how to rub the rice together to use as glue.
Hmm. So. And it works temporarily. Until the day, the next day, when you took it to class and you had to do a show and tell.
Right.
And open up your scrapbook and pieces of material began to fall onto the floor because they didn't adhere.
Right.
What did the teacher give you for that? What grade did you get for that?
Oh, a big fat F.
F. Are things like this still going on around the country, Dr. Trahori? Is this lack of understanding, the fact that mom didn't have any transportation, doesn't have a lot of money, the fact that they put a lot of effort into this, but it didn't come to fruition. Creativity was not rewarded, just execution. Is that still going on, this lack of understanding here?
Absolutely. It is still going on, and it's not necessarily, you know, like the teacher's fault, but it's because the teacher can't imagine these circumstances. It's not in the teacher's experience. And that's why the preparation of teachers at the university that includes diverse education on diverse students is so critical, because you need to understand so many other things that could be factors. And, I was sitting next to a student who was told to write an early essay early years, and that was the class assignment. And the student turned to me and said, "My early years were war. I cannot write about that." And I was sitting next to the student, so I asked the teacher, I said, "Could this student write about a later time in life?" And she just said, "No, if she doesn't do that, she'll fail." And she didn't. She walked out, and she actually didn't ever come back to school. She dropped out of school.
Let me turn it to CMS. Would that kind of thing happen in our system today?
Unfortunately, sometimes it does still happen. And unfortunately, sometimes we still have individuals that feel that immigrant students and families should be assimilated, not acculturated, into our system, which is the, you know, melting pot versus salad bowl concept.
Right.
And you know, for example, I do still have people that say, you know, if we provide interpretation, what's the incentive for them to learn English? So where we are right now to where we are when I came to the United States, it's night and day. And we have established wonderful strategies for ESL students, you know, students from English as a second language, and other programs to help them incorporating to the mainstream. But still, you know, here and there you do find people that that are still reluctant to provide the level of support that the students need.
I would think in many cases, maybe in your case, in the case that Dr. Trahori talked about a second ago, that the system itself may be unaware of what's going on day to day in a particular classroom with an immigrant student and a teacher, and maybe the teacher is not at fault because he or she does not really understand the circumstances. They can't even imagine the circumstances. But when the system finds out through one way, by hook or by crook, does the system try to address the problem? Does the system bring the student and the parents and the teacher together to try to give some context?
I can answer from CMS's perspective. The fact that we're one of the few districts that have a diversity office allows us to look at diversity from a cultural, multicultural perspective and human relations perspective versus other districts that have an office of compliance might be the closest thing, which is looking at diversity from the perspective of the law. We just do what we need to do in order to comply. So the fact that within CMS we do have a diversity office, I think, helps us address many of those issues. And those issues do come up once in a while. And when they do, we work with both individuals and the families to try to find a resolution to it.
I mean, teachers are human beings. They're no better or worse than the rest of us. But although when I was in school, I thought they were God. but they are educators, and they're educated. So it would seem to me that once you point out that, for instance, your mom had to work enormous numbers of extra hours to buy a scrapbook for you, and she did it, that ought to be taken into consideration. And that kind of thing, once presented to a teacher, the teacher would then begin to understand that perhaps I need to think about this student in a different way or find a different way to deal with that student. Is that what's happening once most teachers find out today about the special extraordinary circumstances?
I think absolutely. I think teachers embrace knowledge, and that when they are informed about student circumstances and situations, that they are more often than not willing to, you know, embrace the differences that exist. But the problem lies within, you know, teacher preparation. We're working very, very hard to help prepare teachers for the great diversity here in Charlotte in particular. And it's impossible really to isolate, you know, these very specific circumstances. And so we in the College of Education, I know, work very hard to kind of broaden that base to get teachers to want to seek out information for themselves so that they don't need someone to point out the specifics necessarily.
And Dr. Chahori, you're an expert in urban education, and it's no secret that urban schools face significant challenges, and the teachers in those schools face significant challenges. Is it asking too much of a teacher to superimpose yet another thing they have to be responsible for, immigrant children and their family circumstances, to understand them and to take that into consideration, along with all the other things we've asked them to do? Is it too much?
I think what is too much is to expect that teachers can mitigate all society factors within their classroom, and that they can take all the challenges and turn them into successful students. I definitely believe a teacher can have an enormous impact on students and help them learn and help them include everyone in the classroom and learn from everyone in the classroom and help everyone become successful. However, there are so many factors in urban communities that are outside the realm of the teacher's responsibility. So I think it's a community effort, and I think we need to do much more in community building to help our teachers.
You've already alluded to one of the major things that people say about immigrants, Jose Hernandez Perez. You said that if we provide translation services, what is their motivation to learn English, and we want this to be a melting pot and not a salad bowl. Come here and be an American. Don't be a hyphenated American. And there are those who see immigrant children as a drain on the system because of all those things, the need for special education, the need for education, English as a second language. But CMS Superintendent Peter Gorman made a point of saying in a speech he made a few years ago that we are actually one of those students are one of the system's biggest assets, because as a result of their presence in the classroom, CMS students, quote, will be naturally at ease in a multinational economy because they have sat next to, eaten lunch with, and taken class with students from more than 100 different countries before they ever leave high school. Given the globalization of jobs and the economy, is that message getting out, do you think? And do you think it's valid?
Oh, it's a very valid message. And I'll give you a quick example of that particular point. One of our elementary schools they have a large number of Spanish-speaking students, but they also provide Spanish classes for all students. And I remember a parent, an African-American parent, shared with me that she went to a PTA meeting, and her child started speaking Spanish to a Spanish-speaking parent, and she didn't know that her child had become so fluent in Spanish. And so what I'm thinking is, here's an African-American child in a high-poverty school mm-hmm. that is now not only learning the subject, but it has become bilingual and bicultural, and it's giving this child the opportunity to compete professionally sure. at a much higher level. And I would say a higher level of American, if we use the American term, that would be competent and competitive in a global economy. Mm-hmm. So not only are we looking at immigrant children and how they can benefit from our success as a country and our education system, but how these immigrant children are improving the lives of the rest of the students.
We've done a gazillion shows on education on this program, and it seems to me that education is a three-legged stool. It is the student, the teacher, and the parents. And so often the parents are the one leg that we leave off the stool, and the stool doesn't stand up without the parents' help. And when you have immigrant children and immigrant parents, it seems to me that you have an extra difficulty. In your mother's situation, she tried her best to help you and did the best she could. Then there are situations where kids come home and they're beginning to learn English, and they bring home their English homework, and their parents can't help them because they don't speak English. How do you get beyond that problem? Because all children need help with their homework.
I think in those cases, you have to depend on the community. You have to depend on teachers working a little extra harder to support these kids. We have to remember that the parents of immigrant children are working very hard. Some of them work in 2-3 jobs, mm-hmm. working all the time, and their lack of involvement in school is not, by choice, but more of by situation. I know many, many families who want to be more involved, but just can't because they're trying to survive. So we do depend on advocacy groups and community organizations and teachers.
Are there tutoring services in our school system right now to help these kids whose parents can't help them?
Yes, there are, for example, with Parent University, there are classes in Spanish for parents to help them understand not only how to help their children with homework, but also how and why you should participate in conferences with teachers. What resources are out there? Technology has been a great resource for education. So, again, with larger population groups, it's easier. My concerns sometimes are with smaller population groups that might not have the same level of community support. But even with that, there are plenty of workshops and strategies that we try to put in place to help every student.
We have a call on this topic from Ulrike. Is that how you say your name in Charlotte?
Yes. Hi, Mike.
Hi. How welcome.
As a first-generation immigrant myself, I'm listening with fascination to your wonderful program. And I wanted to tell you that about 8 weeks ago, our stepson joined us from the Dominican Republic, and so your topic today was just like hitting me between the eyes. I wanted to let you know two things that I learned. If the support, just what you just said, Mike, if the support from home is there, the results can be amazing. But it's also that there are great resources in the Charlotte-Mecklenburg school system. I have to say that the International Center on Marsh Road was very helpful. Especially Ms. Vargas. I don't want to name any names, but fabulous. There were some really great people who understood and were really supportive and understood the situation also and the urgency. And then there are some programs at CPCC that I didn't even know about existed. So for me, this was a learning curve again, because when I came here, I already spoke English. But my stepson has made such incredible strides. And I have to say the school where he goes is the Charlotte-Mecklenburg School System Senior High School, Philip O'Berry. Fabulous. I mean, once he was in there, the support has been tremendous. His ESL teacher is fabulous, and the administration is very supportive. So in a lot of ways, if you can use the resources, you can have a very successful beginning. But you're right. If the parent is not fluent in the language, that can be a little bit more daunting.
And we'll leave the segment with that positive comment. You can take that back to the superintendent when you leave for the day. We're coming right back with more Charlotte Talks on WFAE. And our program is made possible in part today by Joseph Beth Booksellers, presenting author and filmmaker Ken Burns, September 14th at 12 noon. He'll be signing and discussing Dayton Duncan's The National Parks, America's Best Ideas, josephbeth.com. Over 80% of public radio listeners form a more positive opinion of companies that support our programming through underwriting announcements. Find out how to make a difference for public radio and for your business. Email underwriting@wfae.org. Coming up at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, a conversation about poverty in America, how the recession has cut across race and income levels to push millions more Americans into poverty. It's coming up at 10 o'clock, and if you'd like to join our conversation, now is the time, 704-926-WFAE, that's 704-926-9323, 800-603-WFAE, or Charlotte Talk, or wfae.org/Charlotte Talks.
Last September, the economic meltdown rallied the financial community around government solutions. Now the crisis has eased, but so has consensus.
I don't think you need an agency for the banks. I mean, you may need an agency for everybody else, but we're saying is we do not need an agency for the banks.
Moving forward from the financial crisis, but in what direction? That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 FM WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Rosemary Trehari joins us by phone from Washington. She's Assistant Professor of Urban Education at UNC Charlotte. In our studio here at Spirit Square, Jose Hernandez-Perez, who is a diversity specialist with CMS, and Dr. Lon Quach, Assistant Professor of Middle, Secondary, and K-12 Education at UNC Charlotte. We're talking about educating immigrant children and how you deal with that both as a teacher and a parent and a student, and be you a native-born student or an immigrant student, the challenge is there. And one of the challenges, it seems to me, is that children are like sponges, and they adapt quickly to a new environment as best they can, it seems to me. And they're probably more quick to adapt this culture and make it their own than their parents, because their parents are trying to struggle to make a living, and they're just trying to make ends meet and make it happen. And also they have had 20, 25, 30 years of life in their previous existence, and it's hard to change. It's hard to become, to assimilate, it seems to me. So when the children do, that must set up friction within the house. When the child is trying to be an American, and mom is Vietnamese, or mom is Mexican, or mom is French, it's got to be difficult. Was it difficult in your situation?
Absolutely, and one of the consequences of assimilation is loss of native language. And we all know from research that, you know, when you lose the capacity to communicate with your parents, with your grandparents, with your, you know, extended family, that can create a lot of friction. So the importance of learning English should be supported. However, we also need to advocate for the maintenance of native language, native languages, because that can create a lot of friction. And our students, many of our students become translators, as like I did. I remember calling insurance companies, you know, at age 9, communicating with various agencies, very grown-up things, because my parents lacked the knowledge of English. And so that puts you also in a power position with parents.
Yes, with your parents. Mm-hmm. But there's also this cultural thing where you suddenly, and maybe it wasn't the case with you, but there are cultures that have native dress that is substantially different from ours. There are cultures that come in here with different, completely different foods than we would eat, and different hairstyles and different customs of modesty. And let's face it, we're pretty out there in America. So when those forces come together, when the child is trying to be an American and that doesn't want to look like the native culture that he or she came from, they want to fit in, they want to wear the baggy pants and the sweatshirt and the tennis shoes and not the native dress, and they don't want to do all those things that mom and dad would have done in their native culture. What does that do to the stress level within the family and with the child at school?
Well, I think he adds an additional barrier to the challenges that a parent faces to educate their children. On the average, when you're compatible with a particular culture, you have the challenges of age and growing up and having teenagers and all of that. But you add to that the component of trying to maintain your culture, maintain your heritage while adapting to a new one. And then there's this gap that is created between the student or the child and the parents. And it creates a, for in my case, and I'm not sure if it's the same case with Dr. Quach, I'm not a pure Latino. I've been influenced by the North American culture, and I'm a different individual. So when I go to Colombia, for example, where I'm from, I have a slight Spanish accent. I have an English accent, an American accent. And when I'm here, I have a Spanish accent. So you have this huge generation of students that are basically this middle ground that we tend to be the bridge between the cultures, which is an important asset for our families and our community.
Chris on Twitter writes, imagine yourself in a foreign country facing the challenges immigrants in the United States do. Amazing the tenacity and perseverance that they exhibit. And that's, we've been isolated and insulated by two oceans and thousands of miles. We speak, we're predominantly monolinguistic. We speak English only and sometimes not very well. And we haven't been exposed to a lot of other customs and places. So everything foreign is really foreign to us, which I guess is another impact that, that students coming from these countries that may have exposure to other cultures other than their own don't understand. We don't in many cases. Religion is another aspect of all of this that's coming in into play here, because now we have all these people coming in who are not necessarily Protestant Christian. So how does the school system deal with that? Because that involves youngsters taking days off that are not part of the Christian calendar, youngsters coming in who may have to pray several times a day, youngsters coming in who perhaps on certain holy days in their religion have to dress certain ways or do certain things. How do you deal with that?
Education, awareness, systems and strategies in place to make sure that we accommodate to the different needs of our students. And again, I'm advocating for my office here again, but having a diversity office that is able to facilitate sometimes when a teacher has a question about a student, for example, leaving on Fridays to go pray at noon. Or having to accommodate for example, certain students that you have to accommodate in art class, something as simple as art class, where there are certain things that some students, because of their religious background, can't draw, then we make certain accommodations with that.
What would that be at a grade or a high school level? Because you're not drawing nudes.
Yeah, in some more orthodox, for example, Muslim faith, in the Muslim faith, drawing people is not acceptable.
And with regard to Muslim students, they do pray several times a day. Have rooms been set aside for that to be allowed to happen?
Yes, sometimes schools do accommodate, predominantly in high school, mm-hmm. is when students seem to want to express their faith. Mm-hmm. And if they go to a principal, they'll find a place where maybe it might not be necessarily the times that they need to pray, because there are certain times in which prayer is required.
And we don't make accommodation for that?
We make an agreement in which bottom line is we can't interrupt the educational process of the students. Uh-huh. So they will pray at different times or during lunchtime. There will be accommodations made so that it doesn't interrupt the classroom environment.
Okay. Dr. Troyori, you've written this book called This Isn't the America I Thought It Would Be, about African students coming from Africa. We've talked just briefly about this a few minutes ago. But this was done in Philadelphia, is that correct?
Yes.
In the Philadelphia public schools, which are rife with urban inner-city problems, it seems to me. And you made mention of the fact that African-Americans had preconceived and incorrect notions about who these young African students were. Was the reverse true? I mean, did African students naturally gravitate toward African Americans?
Yes, they gravitated, calling them brother and sister upon arrival. However, the reaction was such that they quickly learned that it wasn't reciprocal. And then they began to learn all the stereotypes that exist in America, and they put them on them. So, lazy, rude, violent, criminals, not interested in education, all of the ridiculous stereotypes that exist within the context of the United States, they adopted them, and that caused even more conflict between the two groups. So you had misinformation, stereotypes on both sides, and that's what I worked on to try and bring the two groups together by focusing on common values, common history, common culture, common aspirations, and common lived experiences, so that they looked at day-to-day life. They interviewed each other. They made charts about values. They saw films together and began to discover that there was a lot more they had in common than that they had ever imagined.
Were you successful?
Yes. In fact, I was so successful, I didn't really even imagine that I would have been as successful as I was. But the sad thing was that what we all learned together was that a crowd don't learn. That's one of the students' quotes. And what I had done in a small group with 10 African-American and 10 students from the continent, from 8 different countries, bringing those small group, that small group together, it was very successful. But what they said was that in school, usually what happened were large multicultural assemblies, and they didn't work. And so their request was that the school would take on small group working together, and that they would have acted as facilitators, the students. However, I had to go write a dissertation, and so I wasn't there to be an advocate, and it didn't happen. Hmm. So it's one of the reasons why I keep promoting this, is that I'm hoping that the idea that face-to-face interactions with students to help each other understand each other, focusing on what's in common, focusing on common values, and focusing on where these stereotypes come from, because none of them initiate them. In fact, the teachers don't initiate the stereotypes of Africa that exist as jungle and savage, and, you know, students were called carrier of the AIDS virus and told to go back to Africa and that kind of a thing. That's not originated from particular individuals. That's something within the kind of climate that we breathe. It's kind of the smog of our cultural distance from each other. And that can be broken down when students begin to get more accurate information about, for example, the continent. And the continent is made up of 54 countries and a billion people who speak 1,500 to 2,000 languages, and that the children are sons and daughters first, and that their names may mean something. And so the student may be even from a common country as someone else, but Sudan, for example, has a war going on between North and South. And so all those kinds of things like can be made available when students have the chance to come together and interact.
Are there similar things going on among Asians, maybe Asian students who have been here for a generation or two, and then a newcomer comes in from Asia who doesn't speak English? Same thing would be true for maybe somebody named Lopez, for instance, whose parents and grandparents have lived here forever, and they are completely American. They don't even think about necessarily where they came from. I don't think about Ireland ever. And then they are confronted with somebody who just came here from Colombia, from Ecuador, from Venezuela. And it's culture clash even for them, even though they have Hispanic or Asian roots. Is that still happening?
Absolutely. And teachers, I think the first reaction is when you see, say, when you have an Asian student in your class who has been here, maybe born here, and is very well knowledgeable about the school rules, and then there's a newcomer, maybe even from Vietnam, who comes. The natural tendency for teachers is to pair them together without realizing that that one particular student has worked really, really hard to for whatever reason, distance himself or herself from, you know, maybe a newcomer to try to fit in. And so what I always tell my, you know, teacher education candidates is that the best buddy, if you will, is a very, very loving native English speaker to bring that child, you know, into the classroom and make them feel a part of the community, not necessarily assume that if there's a Jose in your class and that Emmanuel comes, that they're naturally going to be friends.
Right.
But
and there are this, we forget that we are in the eastern part of the United States, particularly within the Latino community, there's this struggle of remembering that there's also a West Coast, and there's a history and a tradition that came that comes from that area in which they have experienced things first before we did because of the diversity in that area, in the history. And so in our case, the challenge is, for example, people from Puerto Rico that are bilingual, that are born American citizens, and people do not understand that they are American citizens and they're treated as if they were not. The
right.
Same thing with people that are from American Indian backgrounds, that are from Latino background also, that are generational Americans that have been here for many centuries, and they're treated in this country as if they were immigrants, and sometimes, and that is a difficult place to be
right.
for many people.
Let's go back to the phones. Carl in Charlotte, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call, and I have a funny little incident to share about this discussion.
Do it quickly because we're almost out of time. Go ahead.
Right. Okay. I've been in Charlotte for 15 years. In the 11 years before that, I lived in Venezuela, where both of my daughters and my daughter's brother was born. I hate the word stepson, so let me just say my daughter's brother. And he has had. It took him a long time to start talking when he started talking way late.
I have 30 seconds, Carl.
And so anyway, we got here, and it was time. In back in '94, it was time to enroll him in kindergarten, and so they talked to him at the education office, and they of course they couldn't communicate with him. So they said he's got to have ESL, and I said no, the boy understands the problems you're hearing him have in English are the same problems he has in Spanish. He understands both languages equally as well.
And the solution was?
I convinced him he needs speech therapy, but they wouldn't listen to me. They bussed him 45 minutes away, both rides, 45 there and 45
Now, this was described, Carl, this was described as a funny incident. This doesn't sound funny at all to me.
Well,
all right, Carl, I got to let you go because I'm out of time. I'm completely out of time. Is there anything that we should know that we don't know from what we have talked about today? In other words, have we just scratched the surface here?
We have.
Okay.
We have.
I wish I had more time, but I don't. Jose Hernandez-Perez from CMS, Dr. Rosemary Traore, who's Assistant Professor of Urban Education at UNC Charlotte, and Dr. Lan Quach with UNC Charlotte as well. Thank you all for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you.